So usually on this podcast, we talk about the youngest members of Congress, what they're doing, what they're saying, and why it's important to know about them. Sometimes we also interview people who we find particularly interesting and might have some important things to say about what's happening in the world, and that is the case today. So I have kicked Anthony and Michael off of the podcast today so that I can have an intimate conversation with a very good friend of mine who I think has some important insight to offer us about the unfolding situation in Israel and Gaza and around the Middle East. My friend Allie Levine is a senior technology writer at Forbes. She writes investigative features covering technology and society, and previously spent years covering tech for Politico and as a staff writer, as a columnist at the New York Times. So needless to say, she has a breadth of experience. And in today's episode, we're going to talk specifically about how we can look through the lens of technology at what is happening in the Middle East. This conversation is so interesting and offers so many different perspectives, and I knew that seeking her out was going to enlighten me and hopefully enlighten you in the process. So please enjoy this episode of Political Playlist Happy Hour.
You are going to vote tomorrow in the election.
The millennial generation is the
America's youngest
Congress
since 1960.
The political revolution of the millennials.
Welcome to Political Playlist.
All right, are we ready, guys?
Happy hour. Hi, everybody, and welcome to Political Playlist Happy Hour. I'm Anna Muskie-Goldwyn, and I'm flying solo today with my amazing friend, Allie Levine. Hi, Allie.
Hey, Anna. Good to see you.
Thank you so much for being here. I have kicked the boys out because I wanted to talk to you one-on-one as friends about an issue that is setting Instagram and social media and everything afire, not to mention the physical world itself in the Middle East. And as a writer at Forbes, an accomplished journalist, and a Jewish American woman, I felt that you are a really interesting person to talk to. And so I've co-opted you for this episode for myself so I can learn a little bit and hopefully have the kind of conversations that I hope people, and specifically young people around the country and the world, are having, instead of just kind of, you know, posting shit and slinging stuff around the internet. So, you know, first off, I just wanted to jump in because this is a very exhausting time for people. And I can only imagine how much more it is exhausting if you work in the news. So I kind of just wanted to ask a super general question of like, how are you?
Well, thank you for asking how I'm doing. I guess I would say some days are better than others. I think that you put your finger on it, that it's really hard to set boundaries for mental health and personal well-being when being plugged into the news and also as a tech reporter, being plugged into social media constantly is par for the course of what, you know, what I'm expected to do. That said, I also feel incredibly fortunate to be in a position in the middle of all of this to be able to write and report and ask questions of virtually anybody, and also to be able to provide people with authoritative news and analysis and reporting at a time when there's just misinformation like crazy everywhere. And when everybody on Instagram is a journalist, or everyone on Instagram thinks that they are now a journalist. And I feel very called to be somebody who is using my platform to deliver good, authoritative, solid, deeply reported and verified information to people.
Yeah, I think feeling useless is one of those things that we all struggle with and often can be the reason that we feel so compelled to sort of just like share whatever we see because we want to do something. But I think having a platform as you do, I can see that being very helpful. And so speaking about that platform, you work at Forbes, you're a technology reporter, and I have to imagine that when the attacks happened in Israel and then the subsequent, you know, bombings in Gaza, and now sort of foot patrol is happening in Gaza, you guys have been, you know, reporting on this throughout the company. But what are some of the guidelines that you, as a reporter and sort of within your sphere, both at your company and in general, have been told in terms of how to approach such a sensitive issue and an ongoing issue?
Full disclaimer, I'm not a war correspondent. Obviously, yeah. I'm based here. You said my role is technology and I cover mainly social media platforms. So my goal as a beat reporter on the tech beat has really been trying to figure out and sort of examine ways that tech mm-hmm. and social media are being used or that the tech industry is being affected by this. And so for me, a lot of the issues that I've been covering for years are very much at the center also of what, you know, what we're focusing on from like a tech perspective with regards to the Israel-Gaza war. So for example, I've been writing about mis and disinformation for quite a while. That's obviously hugely, a huge piece of this, given how rampant misinformation is, disinformation as well. And I wrote just last week about, you know, one example is I wrote just last week about college campuses, how there are fake social media accounts and anonymous accounts on other kinds of platforms that are geared towards college kids that are really not even being used to sway opinion. They're just being used to turn people on the campuses against each other, which I think has been very interesting to see because I wrote several years ago, as did many other journalists, about how there was that same kind of disinformation was being used to create chaos around the 2016 election. And I think that it's not that unusual to see these things happen in the midst of really high stakes national global events, elections being a previous example. But it's been really interesting to see how mis and disinformation are just dividing and creating chaos on college campuses the way that we have seen them do, you know, in past high stakes events.
Can you explain a little bit about how you wrote about this profile you found on Facebook that you initially were interested because it shared an alma mater with you, and then you kind of started digging and it was like, oh, this is completely fake. How can you just elaborate on how an account goes into Facebook and creates division? Like, what sort of tactics does whoever is running that account use?
Sure. So I think what's really interesting is Facebook, as we all know, is like the OG platform where you're supposed to sign up as yourself. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to sign up with your actual name and you're supposed to sign up with your actual face. Obviously, with every subsequent platform, basically since Facebook, we've moved away from being our authentic self to having different usernames, sort of like you can remember in the 90s, people using, you know, screen names. And then as we have moved beyond Facebook, we've also moved into this model where you're not just like Facebook is really you're focused on you're most connected with your friends. You're connected with your acquaintances, many of them loose acquaintances, but they're people really that you know. Every platform really since then has now kind of culminating with TikTok is a step away from people you're connected with and more just networks of people who may be complete strangers, but you're being shown what everyone is consuming, and you're not necessarily being shown what your friends are posting. You're being shown what's going most viral. And then the app is testing to see if you want to engage with it. And if you do want to engage with it, it'll show you more things like that. So the model is completely different between when Facebook was created and now. To go back to your question about how a person signs up for Facebook and starts using it as a tool to just create chaos, you can pretty easily sign up for this platform now, mm-hmm. as many others, not using real credentials, not using a name that sounds like it's real, but that is not. And there's so many ways around. It's not very difficult. Mm-hmm. In this case, it was a profile that used a pretty generic name of an American woman. They found a photo, actually, of a young Shakespearean actress in Dublin. They took several of her personal photos from her own social media and used that in their profile picture and other photos that they posted to try to make it seem like this was a persona, an authentic persona. Mm-hmm. And they used the credentials of three pretty reputable schools, University of Pennsylvania, Georgetown, and Fordham. And then they were ready to go.
Wow.
And they clearly had built a network of more than 2,000 friends. The friends, at least many of the friends, we also looked at their profiles, and many of them were posting the same kinds of content, which raises questions about whether there was some kind of coordinated activity going on before, you know, between these accounts that were all reposting each other and sharing similar content around the same time. Unfortunately, we, in the course of our reporting, when we asked Facebook about this, Facebook got to it before a bunch of researchers that we had also asked similar questions to got to it. So Facebook actually took it down before the researchers could really get into it. But and Facebook came back to say, you know, we don't, from what we saw, we don't believe that this was some kind of larger coordinated thing. Mm-hmm. But we, you know, we saw some unusual activity and we still felt strongly that it was worth, you know, writing about. To your question about like what they were saying and doing to just to sow discord, it was really inflammatory posts, most of them attacking Israel. Mm-hmm. But some of them I would say were hate speech. Some of them were misinformation. And really interestingly, and this is something that some of the experts that we spoke to called out, this account actually did not start with the Israel-Gaza war. Mm-hmm. Before Israel-Gaza, this account was posting really inflammatory, divisive content about the Ukraine-Russia war, notably promoting Russia, attacking Ukrainians, and even in some posts going so far as to call Ukrainians Nazis.
Wow.
And mixed in with that, you also have language casting doubt on vaccines, on the COVID vaccine, and you also have posts championing China and China's policies. So all this
like all over the place.
Yeah. So, but the most recent stuff since October 7th and all really just like anti-Israel diatribes. And the stuff is pretty dangerous in a sense, like I said, that it was hate speech and also misinformation, you know, nation about without repeating and just like, you know, amplifying hate speech and misinfo, just, you know, statements about the music festival in southern Israel, claiming that no one had died there and that Hamas was very nice to everybody. Even though now it's well documented exactly what happened there. So the account, you know, the school said, none of the schools that we reached out to would say whether they had seen us on a broader scale. But we did obtain a letter from a really high ranking school administrator. And he wrote to a group of board members that he believed that they were, this account was basically an AI generated account that was looking to just divide people on the campus.
Specifically on campus. I think that, you know, we talked about this amongst ourselves on this podcast that, you know, the thing that I find so scary about all of it is that, like, when you're in college, you're not fully aware of what your identity is yet. I mean, I don't even think I'm aware of what my identity is yet. None of us know. And like, you definitely don't know when you're in college. And so I think that knowing that there are accounts like this and people out, you know, sort of agents of chaos out there targeting college students when there are, you know, there are valid things to be concerned about from almost every angle that you look at a complex situation like this, but kind of really honing in on like, how can we take the malleable minds of university students, specifically in America, but all around the globe, and do something with that to basically just create complete chaos is really scary. And I would feel, if I was a college student, like it's really hard to check sources. It's really hard to not be influenced by kind of what comes up on your TikTok scroll. So that's super fascinating. And, you know, just to one more question on this, like when you look at an account like this and you're looking at the things that they're posting, is there any way to understand, you know, what I find so fascinating about what you said is like their positions, whether it be previously about Ukraine, then whether it be about China or the vaccine, it does not align at all with like the typical progression of an American political view. You know, if you kind of take a step back, it's like you have sort of more far left progressives sort of potentially echoing some of the anti-Israel sentiment, whether that be intentional or not. But then you would not think that those same people would be saying anything pro-Russia, as most progressives in America are pretty staunchly defending helping Ukraine and going back even further. So what, when you look at an account like this, like this is maybe a really difficult question to ask, but what do you think is like the calculation that somebody is making when they're making this account? Is it just they want to see the world burn, or is it that they actually have views that they're trying to put out there and get people to kind of like rally behind in this really messed up way?
I think that's a great question. And I think that, well, I should say that we don't know who is behind the account.
Yeah.
We're not able to figure it out. Facebook did not divulge who was behind the account, where it originated from. Mm-hmm. But one of the first things that came to my mind, and also what was raised by some of the experts that we went to, was this very well could be an account created by somebody who lives in a country that is that is a U.S. adversary. Mm. And instead of it being, you know, a student or someone mm-hmm. outside the student body or somebody who's really far left or really far right who's living in the U.S., the reason that that was a thought that we had, and again, this is not confirmed, mm-hmm. the reason that was a thought that we had was because the kinds of pro-Russia, pro-China messaging that was on that had been on this account before the war, and then also the divisive stuff that was being posted by this account once Israel Gaza started, really just harkened back to other things we've seen from Russia and China and even Iran mm-hmm. that just sought to meddle in politics of other democratic countries just to get people to go for each other's jugular. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. not even trying to convince people to think one way or the other, but just to get people in these democratic places really mad at each other, to undermine democratic processes in past cases, to undermine elections. And the thought that we had was, and again, this is not verified yeah. because we couldn't figure out who was behind the account, but the thought we had was this very well could be somebody who's not living in the U.S., who's on mm-hmm. the far left or the far right, mm-hmm. but it could actually be an adversary.
Yeah.
Right now I'm working on another story. We're seeing if we can even, you know, report this out, about text messages that allegedly family members of hostages have been receiving from unknown senders. And the senders claim to be Qassam Brigade. They claim to be Hamas. And these text messages that I've reviewed some of them, they are basically warnings. Hmm. And they're saying things to the effect of, we have your family member. This is the name of the person that we have. This is what we are asking your government for. Your government is refusing. If your government refuses, .. Mm. And then click this link to be in touch with us further about what you can do. And so right now we're investigating that. Obviously, the burden to prove that this is Hamas is very high. But a natural question that we had was, could it be someone from China, Russia, or Iran? Mm-hmm. Could it be that it's actually also people who are looking to engage in kind of this psychological warfare?
Right, right.
Create more chaos. So don't have any answers to that now, but I think it's very interesting that there are kind of all of these threads that may not necessarily be new, even though the war is, you know, like 40, we're 40 days in roughly. A lot of these threads actually are not that new, unfortunately.
Totally. Do you to kind of take the situation that is happening right now and put a bit of a wider lens on it, you've been reporting on technology for a long time. I know I have sat with you while you're scrolling through TikTok looking for something for a story that, you know, have you found, again, you're not a psychologist, so I'm not trying to get like an exact answer, but just based on your educated opinion, have you found like either experts or talking to people, why this kind of basically psychological warfare works so well on us now? Like, you or I or anyone, like, we're not immune to it, that we see something and we have a reaction to it, or we have the impulse to repost it or to fight against it or whatever, that these agents of chaos, even if we can logically identify, like, this probably isn't real or this probably is more extreme than it should be, it's impossible for us not to have a reaction and to let that kind of sow into our own social media presence or our own discussions with people. Have you, whether it's about the Israel-Gaza situation or kind of just further back, formed an opinion of why we have developed this brain that is so susceptible to these potential agents of chaos that could have really, you know, harmful intentions?
I think that, and again, I'm not a psychologist.
Yeah, I'm not holding you to it.
I think that in times like these, there is this immense feeling across the board of helplessness, especially when you are sitting in your perch, in your safe apartment, wherever it is, hundreds of thousands or millions of miles away from the conflict. mm-hmm. where you feel like you just want to help. And a lot of people, because they have social media, and many people on social media have pretty large platforms, feel that what they can do is exercise their free speech to help. And I think that that's a great thing. And I think it's important for people that have large platforms to help and to use their voice. I also think it's important for people that have small platforms to also be having these conversations. But I think that because that is one of the only things that people in a state of helplessness, I mean, some people will talk donating to charities, and some people will talk about volunteering, you know, virtually in some way if they can. Those options aside, speaking out is really the only thing that a lot of people can do. And that is why I feel people are, you know, feel this impulse, this draw to react to things that they see, to not really think before they're resharing it, reposting it, and to also just take things at face value, especially because there's this information vacuum there where the main context that most of us have, the average person here, the main context most of us have on what is going on there are from the Israeli military, the IDF, and the Gaza Health Ministry, which is run by Hamas. So, and there's also very few journalists on the ground there. And for the most part, I believe journalists have not been allowed into Gaza mm-hmm. since around 7. So that also, I think, increases people's willingness and ease to believe anything mm-hmm. coming from the tiny handful of sources that are, you know, that are relaying information from inside Gaza. And it's very difficult for people to think or accept otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
So again, without being a psychologist, yeah. I think that part of the reason that people are so inclined to jump in on all of this, to share it, to consume it, to take it as fact, is because using our voices and using our ability to spread information is really the only thing that many of us can do.
That's such a good point. To kind of pull this now in a bit more of a personal direction, if it's okay with you, I was really moved by something that you posted where you had a conversation with your parents about your byline. Your last name is Levine, a Jewish last name. You're a Jewish American woman. And at the time, and I'm sure still, this was, I think, a couple of weeks ago, there have been threats against Jewish American journalists. I'm sure Jewish journalists around the world. Can you just speak a little bit about, you know, what had been happening, what that conversation was like, to the extent that you're comfortable? I just think it's a piece that I had not thought of or heard about until you posted about it. And I think it's something that people should know about and understand a little bit better.
Absolutely. So shortly into this conflict, there was an assistant professor at UC Davis who issued a death threat for Jewish journalists in the US. I can pull up what it said. It said, one group of people, this was in a tweet, one group of people we have easy access to in the US is all these Zionist journalists who spread propaganda and misinformation. They have houses with addresses, kids in school. They can fear their bosses, but they should fear us more. And the tweet ended with a knife emoji, an axe emoji, and 3 blood drop emojis. Whoa. So
just want to reiterate, this is a professor at the University of California, Davis. This is a college professor at a very reputable, large university.
Assistant professor at UC Davis.
Assistant professor.
And so I saw this, and you know that rationally you are sitting in your apartment somewhere and no one is about to, you know, bang down your door and you're going to be fine physically. Mm-hmm. But mentally and emotionally, that takes a toll. And it's not the first death threat. I've gotten death threats in the past that were more targeted at me for things that I've written. But this felt on top of all the other anti-Semitic threats that have been just proliferating. It just felt like another layer to be Jewish and to be a journalist. And that's not to say, by the way, that people who are voicing support for Palestine are not also getting death threats. They absolutely are. There's surge in anti-Semitic and Islamophobic threats, harassment, hate crimes, pretty much across the board.
Right.
And we also know of many instances where students who have been putting, you know, being very vocally pro-Palestine are getting doxxed, which is so horrific.
Mm-hmm.
And threats to their security and privacy, which is horrific. In this case, just as a Jewish person who is also a journalist, though, it just felt like it was there was you know, another layer to the anti-Semitism, which is distrust in the media, and therefore let's go after people who are Jewish and journalists. And I was really disturbed by that. And so this became a conversation that I had with my husband and with my parents, actually with my rabbi, over, you know, over a period of, this is all moving very quickly, but like over a period of several days. And I have chosen to this point to not change my, to not change my background on things. But this is something like my physical security is something I think about constantly. And when you've also got public social media profiles, which is sort of part of the course of being a journalist and also having a job that entails writing about and analyzing social media, there's kind of not a way out of it. My employer has helped me go to pretty great lengths to wipe my personal information off of different parts of the internet, which has been great. But these are all, you know, these are all, I know that there are people that are in much worse off situations than I am. So I'm very aware of that. I just think it's steps that people are taking to be cautious that they probably wouldn't otherwise be taking.
Well, and if like you said, you know, from your safe apartment where, you know, you, like most of us, know that no one's going to come and break into your house on a daily basis. If you're having those feelings, one can only imagine someone who is in an objectively riskier position, but might also have these layers of identity on top of them, might be feeling. And I think that that is something that, at least in my opinion, has escaped a lot of this conversation, is like what the impact of the division, whether it's sowed by fake Facebook accounts or it's just our human nature to disagree about things based on our own experience, you know, the toll that is having, not of course just on the people being traumatized in Israel and in Gaza by this war, but all around the globe who are, you know, either trying to play a part in informing people like yourselves or simply just existing as who they are. And so I thank you for sharing that, because it, when I read that, I was like, holy shit, that's, I never would have thought about that in sort of just my own ignorance sitting in my house, you know, thinking that no one's going to come in. But it was very moving. And I am glad that, you know, you've taken the measures to make sure you'll be okay. But to wrap things up, I wanted to solicit a little bit of advice, because one of the things that we all know journalists have to do is remain objective for the most part. And that is something that I am sure you spend a lot of time both in school and in life navigating. I have to imagine that in this certain situation for yourself and many others who, you know, have a personal toll, as you just explained, in any direction, are dealing with, how do you remain objective? Obviously, you have your own opinions, you have your own thoughts about things. What are the, you know, whether active or inactive steps that you go through to think about a situation without letting your own opinions kind of get the better of you or shape your reporting in any way?
Well, I think that, you know, being objective has been drilled into the minds and the expectations so heavily of what journalists, who journalists are and what they're supposed to be doing, that I, even though I, you know, my identity is I am a Jewish woman, I identify with the religion, I broadly, you know, I feel connected to the religion. I don't feel like it has been difficult to be objective in the things that I've reported. The things that I've reported so far are stories that I don't feel that they're, I don't feel they're stories that can be, they can't exclude one side, they can't exclude one view. May affect, they're stories about things that are affecting everybody. So for example, I wrote this story the other week about how social media is creating chaos on college campuses. It is creating chaos for Jewish students, for Muslim students, for students, no matter where they are from, there's hate speech and threats being lodged at Jewish students and also at Muslim students. And the anonymous emails and the weaponizing of some of these college-focused forums like GreekRank and SideChat and Yik Yak, they're targeting everybody. They're not targeting, you know, I suppose that people could make the argument that one group on may be targeted more on one than another group is targeted on another, but everyone is being targeted. And the story reflected that. And to me, the fact that I am Jewish doesn't make it okay to not write about how it is everybody that's being affected by this, and everybody is not just the Jewish community.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that feels like common sense. I think that when you have people who are using their platforms who are not journalists, and I don't think every journalist is perfect, and I certainly don't think every news outlet is perfect, as we've seen. But like when you have people who are not trained journalists,
mm-hmm.
who don't necessarily know how to put that check on themselves, where there are more perspectives to be considered than just theirs. I call this Instagram journalists.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is where you lose some of the nuance and you lose the ability to, people are just passionate and they want to use their platform again. And I think that is where you lose some of the nuance that is so important that I think that journalists really have hardwired into them to adhere to.
Mm-hmm.
Another story that we did, I think it was in the first week or two of the war, was about Israeli tech startups.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote a bit about how founders were being called to serve and how that was affecting the businesses and how founders move from being, you know, in the business roles, then having to change their entire psychology to then be on the battlefield. And we wrote that story. And a couple of days later, my colleagues, who are wonderful, did another version of the story that looked at Palestinian tech. And there were certainly critics who said, tech is not the most important thing here. Tech is not the most important thing. But what my colleagues discovered was that, you know, in Gaza and in the Palestinian community more broadly, tech and small startups have actually become one very small economic lifeline that has been, you know, something that has been part of, you know, a more promising future for a lot of these people who are living really in poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a fantastic story. And they actually reached people who were in the midst of this crisis who wanted to talk about startups and wanted to talk about how startups had provided them with some path forward in the future. And I was really proud of being part of a publication that ran two stories that looked at, you know, both of those things. And roundabout way of saying, like, in responding to your question, that I think it can be really difficult to separate out who you are from what you are doing. I think that any journalist who says that they don't have opinions or feelings about these things, that's just that cannot be the case, especially in these times. But I think that there are really people who are going to great lengths to remember that they need to be neutral and balanced. And maybe one story, you know, covering Israel and Palestinian tech startups, maybe it's not in the exact same story. Maybe they come out one day apart. Mm-hmm. Based on what the editorial or publishing schedule is that week. But I think it's really important to recognize that there are a lot of people going to great lengths to make sure that we're doing as much storytelling about everybody who's affected by this and the various ways they're affected by this as we can, given that there's sort of this also information, this sort of like information vacuum without us reporting here without actually being physically there.
Of course. And I think then you see everyone, like you said, Instagram journalists trying to fill that vacuum. And one thing I wanted to echo that you had said before is like, it's not that impulse to share comes from a bad place. I think most of us look at people we know and feel they're coming from a place of passion, a place of concern. But I think the reason I wanted to ask this question is just to highlight that, like, it's, you know, it is a good impulse to want to help, but it can be also a very good impulse to try to look at, I'm not even going to say the other side of things, but like another perspective in what you are trying to say. Because I think journalists, as you just said, that is your job. Like, your job is to find those multiple perspectives. And we normal people don't hold ourselves to that same standard. And we don't always have to. But I think, you know, in this situation, it's something that I have found particularly helpful for myself. And so I, you know, not that we're all going to be trained journalists, but I think that if we can maybe put on our hat a little bit to try to practice some of that emotional objectivity is maybe the phrase I would use.
One other thing I would just add is that I think that this, you know, I mean, some people might call it a cliche, the echo chamber.
Yeah.
I think it's very real. And I think that when you think about what we've all been consuming over the last 40 some odd days with this conflict, a lot of us are following people on Instagram who we know, who we agree with. And a lot of people are only getting fed the same stuff over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And there's people within my own network where I see that they're posting things. And I wonder to myself, do they ever question whether anything coming off of this account that they keep reposting mm-hmm. are true? And there's a lot that I see that isn't true. And I think that there's a lot of people who either don't know to think twice about it or actually just don't care. And mm-hmm. I think regardless of what corner of the conflict you're in, you can find people who really just they have their view. It's not going to change. And I think that the echo chamber effect that exists because of social media is extremely real.
I also think we've become a little bit desensitized to it. Like, we sort of just, I think partially because of our political system, at least here in America, like, we just kind of know that to be true. It's like, oh yeah, everyone's in their echo chamber, and like, that's just the way it is. And I find it interesting in this conflict specifically how we're kind of just like okay with it being that way, because we always have been about our own sort of fucked up political movements, that this conflict, which has, in my opinion, like so much more immediate weight than, you know, the person that you, not that whoever you elect doesn't have weight, but like this has like immediate weight if you are posting about it. And I don't know. I mean, it's something that just, as you were saying, that came to my mind of like, we kind of just accept that our echo chamber is there and we don't seem to be that upset about it. And this situation, maybe we need to be a little bit more critical of it.
Yeah. And I sometimes ask myself, whenever I advise people to seek out more than one news source or to go and seek out a news source that they wouldn't ordinarily read or that they think they might not ordinarily agree with, or to put on a different channel. And I actually just wonder, I'm like, who actually ever takes that advice?
Right.
There's no way to measure or test that. But it always occurs to me that that advice is probably mostly falling on deaf ears. And the question of how we actually get people to look beyond what they know or what they think that they know is just, I think, a constant uphill battle.
And that, yeah. This might be maybe the situation in which I offer this to anyone who's listening. It's your chat, like, because it isn't like saying to someone, oh, you know, you're a strident Republican, go watch MSNBC for an hour. It's saying, this is like a really specific situation. Can you maybe find a different perspective and just see what it feels like? You know, I think that I will leave people with your advice that maybe previously has fallen on deaf ears, but I think could perhaps find an audience in this exact moment. Thank you so much. This was exactly what I hoped it would be. I hope that for anybody listening, this is like an example of how to have informed conversations about something that feels really difficult. I sought you out because you are my friend, but you're also an expert in a particular corner of the world that we're living in. And I just found your perspective incredibly helpful. So thank you.
Thank you for having me. And from my corner of the internet to yours, I hope it was helpful.
It definitely was. I will see you soon.
Bye, Anna.